Oh, Sam.
This call is being recorded.
Hey, Gary, how are you?
Oh, pretty good. How's it going?
Oh, not too bad. My call recorder must have updated since I last used it. It's never said you're being recorded at the beginning.
Yeah. Well, that makes sense. An interview, so it should be recorded, right?
Yeah.
That's good.
So, how have you been, man?
Oh, pretty good. I mean, I spent the last couple months trying to finish the record. I just usually work so slow, I just kind of like, you know, whenever I feel like it. Or sort of whenever I feel like it. I just keep like, man, I should work on a record today, but I don't. But finally, that's what usually happens. Finally, I got together about the first part of August and got, you know, I had to finish mostly like guitar solos and stuff. And then mix it, which is always challenging to say the least. I'm not very good at mixing because I'm just not any good at any of the technical aspects, you know, like the levels and all that stuff. Just,
yeah.
You know, if a mixing engineer would look at my stuff and just be frightened about it. That's just so horrible. If the levels are too high and too low and there's noises all over the place. And but I don't worry about that much. You know, I just worry about how it sounds to me. So.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So what was the writing process? Was there anything in particular that inspired certain songs lyrically or anything, or was it just...
Yeah, probably. Yeah, I think, like I started writing stuff right after my cat just stepped on the keyboard and started song. Okay. I started writing stuff a couple years ago, just about 2 years ago, not quite, right after I released the Uniform Curry album. And let's see, and I came up with a title fairly early on because I'd been listening to a lot of older, I kind of went back to listen to a lot of old garage rock and psychedelic stuff that I hadn't listened to in a long time.
Definitely.
Not a lot of new old stuff on YouTube that was really got into, you know. YouTube's amazing for like this sort of deep diving of old and new stuff.
Yeah, because
I was coming up with garage rock songs I've never heard.
Controlled or anything by what people like, you could pretty much upload anything you have in your collection.
Yeah, I know. And like a lot of them never been on any kind of like electronic, you know, CDs or anything like that. So,
exactly.
Or vinyl since they first came out, like, you know, 50 or 60, 55 years ago. So that was the first part of it. Like about a little over a year ago, I started listening to a lot of new stuff because it was like, this is ridiculous. I'm listening to all the stuff that's like 50 some years old. So, you know, and I have over the years, I've listened to some newer stuff and, you know, but like, I don't know. I always look for like, you know, psychedelic stuff that I like. So, you know, I didn't hear the Black Angels for a while, you know, Ben Austin and another band. Baby Woodrose, they're from Denmark. They had a lot of stuff since like around the early 2000s up to even like a couple years ago.
Nice.
What else? I can't remember. I every once in a while I go like to, you know, somewhere, either YouTube or Apple Music or whatever, and try to dig up new stuff. But I never really did it very regularly until about a year ago. I was like, I'm just going to look for new things, and, you know, because there's got to be something new out there. And so I was listening to the second half of the writing process, was listening to a lot of brand new stuff. Like, I discovered, like, first band I got into was King Gizzard and the Wizard Lizard.
They're great.
And, like, the OCs. Yeah, the OCs or OCs, whatever they call them. That's one of my favorite bands right now is the OCs. It's hard to get into them because they got so much stuff. You know, it's like they've been around for, King Gizzard's been around for about 10 years, but the OCs have been around since the late 90s in some form or other with that John Dwyer guy, who's the main songwriter and stuff. And then, the new couple records are really great.
Categories.
They kind of do the five categories. I mean, I kind of got into it. A lot of their stuff, you know, from like 10 years ago or so was pretty kind of garage rocky, psychedelic. Then they started getting more like kraut rock almost influence, like long, like they had like 20 minute long song jams and stuff, like a couple records from like two or three years ago. And then the newer stuff is much shorter, more faster, upbeat, noisy. And I don't know what. A lot of it almost reminds me of something like almost like Devo or something, but like in a you know a little heavier vein or something like that. I don't know if they're influenced by Devo. But, it's kind of slightly quirky. Not too quirky. I mean, too quirky. Right? So I was influenced by old and new stuff at different times. And I like at different times I thought I had all the songs written. And then I'd start writing more songs, especially like the last, since like, I don't know, mainly since the beginning of the whole pandemic thing. I wrote about half the songs since then. Like, what was that song, Cheshire Cat Claws? That was like kind of sort of about our cat Nacho breaking my old SG guitar. I had that 64, it's either a 64 or 67. And I had it on a stand out on my chair, and it was not a very good stand, and she kind of brushed by it and flopped on the ground, broken neck. I haven't got it fixed yet, but hey, still. And then, so I kind of, I already have the song title, and I was like, well, what can I do about that? It's also sort of, you know, none of my songs are ever about one thing. They always have a whole bunch of stuff in them. And a lot of times they're not about anything. They're just kind of like an image thing. But there were actually some songs that were like more about stuff like, what else? Viscous and Pretty. I know people are going to think it's Vicious and Pretty, but it's Viscous and Pretty. The reason I wrote that was
I remember that one.
Yeah, it was like about, I said something in the interview about landing in this book and saying it was Vicious and Petty or something. I was like, then I wrote, it's like Viscous and Pretty, which I don't quite know. Probably means something. I mean, Viscous is like, you know, a gooey sort of gelatinous mass, obviously pretty. So for, it's sort of a, one of those lyrics that's like an oxymoron, a contradiction to itself.
Yeah.
You know, viscous and pretty doesn't really make sense at the same
time. Funny
viscous and pretty. I tried to, I make these little,
The funniest thing for me was that, like, 2 days after I interviewed you, and Kerrang's turned me down multiple times.
Oh, yeah. Well, the guy was some big wig. I had no idea. I didn't know. I just thought this is another interview. I didn't know it was a big magazine. I mean, I guess the Screaming Trees did a Kerrang thing way back in the 90s.
Yeah, it was a big...
They were always more of a...
They were more of the metal
kind of
back.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so I didn't really think about that because I always thought it was kind of weird that we were in Kerrang because we were really metal. They kind of, changed with the times, I guess.
Or maybe so they thought Buzz Factory being released with St. Vitus Music at first by accident. Maybe they thought
you
were.
Yeah, right. I don't know what people thought about that one. That was pretty funny. We were like, oh, man, what is this on our St. Vitus? Well, yeah, we knew it was St. Vitus. So I was like, uh-oh. Yeah, that kind of screwed up that a little bit.
And me,
so,
Trees and Vitus, I can only imagine what people thought when they brought that home.
I know. They thought, man, the Screaming Trees really changed a lot. I got one of their other SST records. This one is, like, completely different.
Well, like, in all fairness, was singing for St. Vitus at the time, so his voice could have possibly passed for Mark's to some people.
Yeah, maybe. You don't know. You don't, I mean, plus you don't know what, you know, back then indie bands, like, what the hell they do on their next record might be completely different. You never know.
Yeah, exactly.
Let's see. Yeah, so I wrote, like, about half the songs I wrote, like, in the last, like, you know, 7 or 8 months. That Colonel Tangerine, Sapphire, Sunshine Dreams, the last song on the album. That was like, I'm going to write the most psychedelic title ever. And it actually it's sort of about Trump, really, because that's the Colonel Tangerine Orange thing, sort of indirectly, sort of a
what would you call it? Not an allegory, sort of a, almost a satire in a way.
Yeah.
About, I mean, all the lyrics are really about, you know, I was definitely thinking of that, like, you know, a crazy dictator type of guy. That's what the bike, the first lyrics about a bicorn hat is like the Napoleon hat, you know, with like the flat one with the two sides, bicorn, two sides.
Yeah.
And this stuff about, you know, it's kind of like that and kind of mixed with, like, I've always written a lot of songs about nuclear war. So it was kind of like, you know, the crazy orange guy has a nuclear war or something like that. I don't know.
Oh, it's something that, so, you know, regardless of where anybody's at on the spectrum, which I belong to,
yeah,
neither.
Yeah.
It's a thought that we're all having and that we've had in our heads. I mean, you got to remember, I'm not even 30 years old, but
yeah,
I was afraid when the towers were hit, and we're still fighting that,
yeah,
war. And that's lasted.
I know. Well,
out.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah, that, well, pretty much is still going on.
Yeah.
But yeah, well, the thing with the nuclear war, people who grew up with the threat of nuclear war, like until about 1990, I mean, you were born right after the end of the Cold War, right at the end of the Cold War.
I was born in,
and it was like a constant, it was like the fucking virus. It's like, you know how people are all worried about the virus now? Well, we were worried about nuclear war all the time for like 30 years, 40 years,
yeah,
you know, 40 years. I was like born in 62, so for me it was about 30 years, but for some people it was even longer, you know. And
yeah,
with like at any second, the whole world could be destroyed. You know, I mean, the threat of that happening now is not near as, maybe, but it probably happened a lot slower. You know? Back then, though, it was like the button.
Like, really necessarily end. It's just they put the world at ease and we'll leave you alone.
Yeah.
Us. But.
Yeah, it's like maybe we won't have the button that's going to destroy everything in one, like in an hour. Maybe we'll like wait and do it a little slower. But yeah, until like I said, until the end of the Cold War, that was a really big thing for everybody. And for me, it really influenced a lot of my songs the old days too, the early Screaming Tree stuff, or like songs,
yeah,
like a Purple Outside song called The Turtle. That was totally like nuclear war.
Which is a great song
sort of
too.
Influence. Oh, thanks. Yeah. So that still comes into songs nowadays, you know. So
well,
that was
that
Colonel Tangerine song's about.
That's brilliant. I mean, it kind of, Mudhoney's last EP, Morning in America, was maybe more direct.
Yeah.
But that was also very satirical because it didn't mention anyone by name, even though, you know.
Yeah, right. Yeah, they did a good job in the last couple records being like, you know, talking about, you know, newer topics without sounding really stupid. You know, like that digital garbage song, that was really cool. I really liked their last record a lot. And
well,
EP too.
Pre-ordered the EP and got it a day before it was put out because I was like,
oh yeah,
new Mudhoney? I'll track that out. So it was called,
yeah,
Morning in America. I kind of guessed it was, you know, having to do with what was going on.
Yeah, right.
They,
well, that's sort of, I think it's a sort of dig on, I think it was Reagan had this Morning in,
yeah,
America,
that was,
like, you know, and it's the, you know, right, yeah, like now it's Morning in America, and like a fucking pretty shitty morning, and that was before
America
this year, so, you know, kept getting shittier the whole time.
There's two things I want to point out. Nixon,
yeah,
claimed to be the law and order candidate, and Reagan,
yeah,
always said,
yeah,
America's great again in speeches. That's all,
yeah,
I need to say.
No. Well, I was like a little early grade school when Nixon was president. But I do remember quite a bit about, you know, like Watergate and all that stuff. But man, I tell you, like the like worship of Trump, there was nothing even remotely like that with Nixon. Nixon was definitely a politician, and it was like he was a human politician,
right,
and he was definitely, you know, when he did start failing, people were like, screw it, we're not going to have anything to do with him. Whereas with,
yeah,
Trump, it's like, you know, people think he's some kind of god or something. I don't know. I mean, it's really bizarre.
Really, like that, because I know a lot of people, my father included, who still says to this day, I loved Reagan, and he was a teenager in 83.
Jesus, really? You loved Reagan? Okay, yeah, Reagan was... I remember Reagan pretty well. I never paid a whole lot of attention to politics back then.
Yeah.
You know, it was easy to not pay attention to politics because the only news sources were newspapers and TV. And it was just the beginning of, you know, like a CNN, like 24-hour news cycle. So if you just watched regular TV, if you didn't tune in at 6 or 11, you didn't see the news. And if you didn't take a newspaper, you didn't see anything. So it was kind of like you'd hear about the big stories. You know, like I remember like when Reagan got shot, like listening to the radio, and that was on for a while. But, you know, mostly didn't pay much attention to politics. And I, even in the 90s, though, I didn't really start paying much attention to politics until the internet, really, you know. So, like, I started using all the internet stuff in the early 2000s. So
I think the access to all these things, all political, I think is horrible because people aren't thinking like people. They're thinking politically.
Well,
they're
yeah.
not thinking human way.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And you can't just, like, ignore it. If, like, you know, it's like, oh, put your phone down or don't go on the computer. But it just doesn't work that way. It's just like they're
no.
integral parts of everyone's lives, you know.
Oyster Cult records speak a lot of stuff like that, too. They have a song on it called
really?
The Machine. Yeah.
Yeah.
They have a song on
it. I haven't listened to that.
Talking about being a slave to the phone because it's pretty much integrated into our society, you know.
Yeah, it's as much, you know, I think the only thing that really besides the smartphone, the only thing that's really changed society as much as the smartphone is probably the automobile. The automobile completely reformed society. And, you know, that's, in fact, I was really thinking about, like, since I was born, you know, things really haven't changed a lot. For, like, my granddad was born in 1902. And between 1902 and the time I was born in 1962, the world totally was completely 100% changed. But since 1962,
yeah.
you know, things aren't really that different. We've got more TV. We've got more of what we had, like technology-wise. But the one
yeah.
thing that has really is computers and especially the smartphone and the connectivity to everybody. That has changed. And it's not
yeah.
necessarily good.
No, it's not. And you're absolutely right. You're not wrong. I can't dispute that because I agree. I think things are a little bit before too, because I notice a lot of the hit songs by modern bands are all cover songs of other people's songs. And
yeah,
that's
true. Well, on the other hand, though, there are good things about it, because, like, with my music, I couldn't be doing what I'm doing now if it wasn't for the internet and for computers, you know? I mean, I'd be still, like, selling tapes on a primitive website or something, or CDs, you know, CDRs. Or something like
yeah.
that. And, you know, just being able to, I mean, geez, I finished my record and I can just put it right out and people can hear it, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't really, you know, I don't know how many people hear it, but enough so I have an audience, you know. I mean, I don't know if it's like a few hundred people. But that's fine with me. That's more than a lot of bands can drum up nowadays, you know. And I don't really play live or anything. So, you know,
that's
especially now with the pandemic. So.
Love to see some of this shit performed live.
Yeah, I'm actually, I think, you know, I'm getting a good webcam. I think I'm going to start maybe like a weekly live thing, maybe on YouTube, because I don't like the Facebook live thing, because you have to turn the camera sideways, and it's not very good quality, and it's like, you don't
yeah.
really have control over what's going on. YouTube seems like, I'm probably in a week or two, I think I'm going to start doing like a, some kind of like maybe like every week or 2 weeks, like a live show and do like 5 or 10 songs, you know, different ones
nope.
every week from all sorts of different, you know, all different time periods and new and old Screaming Tree stuff and new stuff by me. Maybe a couple covers or something. I don't know what YouTube's so weird with that's the one thing with YouTube is like posting songs on YouTube. So if I'm posting these Screaming Tree songs, I'll get these copyright strikes, not actual strikes, but say that you can't monetize it, which I don't even want to do because you make like so little, it's ridiculous, you know, unless you get
yeah.
like a million hits or something. And I'll get copyright strikes from all these different, even if they don't, like on live things where you don't even list the songs, I don't know how they know, the computer knows what the songs are or something. And
I think they have
yeah, it's like some kind of thing that tells what the song is just by hearing it. because I don't think any people listen to it, you know. But the funny thing is though, like they'll even do that when I do acoustic versions of Screaming Tree songs. Say, you have a copyright thing with some, like, you know. And the stupid thing is, it's a publishing company that's publishing our stuff, and I'm the one who's going to get the money for it if they eventually, of course, I'll money from the other guys. But I just put up, I hadn't had any of my actual albums on YouTube, although I think some of the songs had been on there from, like, when you sign up, like, on, I use TuneCore to get stuff on, like, Apple Music and stuff like that.
Yeah.
They, like, put the individual songs up there. But anyway, when I put up Unicorn Curry, just so the album would be up there so people could listen to it on YouTube if they wanted to, I got, like, copyright strikes on it, and it's, like, against me, against, like, Moonbus International Recordings. It's like, okay, I guess I'm, like, sort of, it's almost like...
in Italy.
Yeah, it's kind of like, the Philip K. Dick book, The Scanner Darkly, where he's, like, investigating himself, and he doesn't know it, the cop. It's like, he's, like, they got all the surveillance stuff in his house and everything. He's watching himself, but he doesn't... He's on this drug that splits his brain in two, and he doesn't know that he's watching himself. So it's kind of like, oh, I got a copyright strike. Who was Gary Lee Conner? And then Gary has Moonbus International Recording. That's what I sort of informally call my, I don't really have a record company, but what I, you know, put out stuff, sometimes I call it Moonbus International Recordings. Because I started that back in the 2000s, the website was called the Moonbus. Like after the moon bus in 2001, A Space Odyssey.
Yeah.
So,
anyway, that's hilarious.
So that was funny. Yeah, have getting a copyright strike against us. So they're kinda,
yeah.
But it's really cool to be able to, you know, put stuff up on there, have people hear it. Yeah, I'm concentrating more on YouTube now, not than Facebook, but just more because it's something else. You know, I think that it's cool. Like, I use it so much and to listen to music.
Got less restrictions and less bullshit you have to deal with in order to upload stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, right.
Guidelines almost is non-existent compared to, like, Facebook Live.
Yeah, right.
I saw something recently that said about moving his Facebook page because of Facebook's copyright shit.
Oh, was that I don't know. Was that the thing about the not going to have live streaming or something?
Yeah, something like they're doing live stream now.
Yeah, people were like freaked out about that. It turned out to be nothing. People were thinking that they were going to not allow live stream music anymore because it says something like, we want Facebook to be more like interacting with people or something. We don't want to have a listening experience. What all they meant is they don't want people like uploading records to YouTube and then people listening to them on YouTube. I mean, obviously watching somebody live is pretty interactive, right? You know, because people are making comments and stuff.
Like,
yeah, YouTube doesn't do that. I've never done YouTube live yet, but no. You can't do it on your phone unless you have 1,000 subscribers. I have almost that many. I haven't tried it yet. But you know, webcam, for some reason on mobile, you can't do it unless you have 1,000 subscribers, but you can't. I didn't realize that until the other day. I was waiting because I was thinking, well, I got to get 1,000 subscribers. But then I realized, well, if I get a webcam, I can do it. I have a little more control over what I'm doing because I hate using my phone. Like, you know, I have an iPhone 8. And so, like, the back camera is a lot better than the front camera. But if you use the back camera, you can't see if you're in the frame and stuff. And, you know,
Yeah. Use
it. So I tried all sorts of workarounds. Like,
I
tried
seven. So I know your struggle.
Yeah, that's the thing about technology, especially music technology in the last 20 years or so. It's advanced so much. But especially in the mobile music technology, there's all these problems of, like, you can't use this app with this app. But there have been some workarounds like that. What's the name of that? Is it Audio Bus or one of those things? I don't do too much on the phone and on the iPad, but I've tried to. And it's always like, you can't find the right adapter, like, you know, analogy in real life, you know, but it's like you can't find the right digital adapter. It's like, I want to put this XLR plug into like a 1/8 inch or a RCA, but they don't make an adapter to do it. It's the same thing, like you want to do a drum track on like on GarageBand, but you have like, what's the thing I use, like the I can't remember, one of the amplitude amp. You can't, like, Amplitude, do they have it? I don't even know if they have a drum thing now. That's the thing that really stopped me from doing very much with the mobile phone and iPad music thing, is because the drum apps are just, they don't work. Like, I have a drum app I use on Cakewalk. It's XLN Addictive Drums. And Cakewalk has the simplest step sequencer. It's just like a rows of squares that you fill in to make drum beats or piano or, you know, keyboard stuff. And it's just so simple. And not many people use that. People use that piano roll thing on DAWs. I never, ever liked that. It's just too, I don't know, it's not simple enough. And like, the step sequencer is really clunky looking and not very, you know, cool, but it works great, you know, because you can get down to like however many notes, you know, like 16th or 32nd notes, so, and you can adjust the feel of it a little bit too, so.
Yeah, I'm not sure what my friend used for my tracks that I'm working on for my record, but she used one of the programs, but on a PC.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what my stuff's on. Yeah, my stuff's all on PC, like, that I use. I was talking about, the stuff I don't use is on the iPad and the iPhone. I try, every once in a while, I use demo stuff. But I just, like, got down, finally, I just was like, I only use the, what is it, the onboard sound recorder to, like, if I want to remember a song, I just, like, do it, like, just hit play. Hit record, record it, one track, and then I don't forget it. So
nice.
That was pretty good. Because otherwise you're, like, working around all this technology that you're just is getting in the way. And that's, you know, technology a lot of times get in the way unless you – and that's why I hesitate a lot of times to, like, use new things, because it's like, well, I already know how to use, you know, Cakewalk, which is the one I've used. I've used that since I started with the DAW stuff back in, like, late 2000s.
Yeah.
And it's gone through a lot of problems and companies. Like, for a while, well, it was owned by, I think, Roland was the company that started it. It was one of the first digital workstations for music. And then they sold it to Gibson about three, four, 5 years ago. And Gibson just, like, was like, basically, we're going to just bury it. We don't care about it. So they got rid of it. But then this company called Bandlab made it free. It's kind of irritating because I paid probably $1,000 for all this stuff for more. But on the other hand, now they're like updating it and it's a lot, you know, it doesn't come with all the extra VST instruments and effects, but it's working very nicely now. So and I got a new computer too. Last year I finally got a new computer because the old one I got in 2008, I got pretty much state-of-the-art computer at the time, but it's not like in the 90s where you buy a computer and like 2 months later it's like out of date. It's like more like you can keep a computer for like 5 or 10 years if you get a state-of-the-art one and not worry about it. Man, that was like, I remember we got so many computers like late 90s. We must have gone through about 3-4 computers. They were all like $3,000 a piece, and now they'd be just like, you know, trash.
I remember black and white cowl-looking Gateway boxes as a child.
Yeah. we went for Gateway. That was what, until we got a Dell finally in the early 2000s, but in the 90s we had Gateways all the time. I don't know why, but
I don't know why either.
Yeah, we even bought one at the Gateway store. We lived in New York. There was a Gateway store and bought a new one with a huge monitor.
We had a Gateway store in our home for a couple years in the late 90s as well.
Yeah. That's where when I, the first time I ever used a computer for music was in the, I can't remember if it was a Gateway or a Dell. I think it was a Gateway. And I had this program. It was just like one of those you buy like at Best Buy. It was like $40 and I can't remember what it was even called. But I remember just plugging my stuff in to the back, like microphone, and having no latency at all. I don't know what the deal was, but I recorded, I have several songs on my demo collections that I actually recorded on that. I can't remember exactly which ones, but some from the early 2000s. And, you know, nowadays, it's like, in order to get no latency, you have to have some really fancy sound, external sound cards and stuff. I finally got my setup now, and I don't have really any latency to speak of. But, man, like, when I first got my computer, like, in the late 2000s, and trying to figure out what kind of sound card to use, I was still trying to use internal sound cards, which are really not, they don't seem to make them near as well as the external. Like, now I got some Focusrite thing with 4-input channels, and it seems to work really well. So, but yeah, the computer technology is really, you know, that's a big part, talking about a lot, but that's a big part of what I do is, you know,
oh, yeah.
I couldn't make the kind of stuff I do without the computer. I mean, everything I do, you know, is on the computer, even like all the keyboards, like all those fancy keyboard parts. But I didn't have much keyboard. I intentionally limited the keyboards on this new record. But in fact, I didn't use anything except for, they're samples, but organs. I didn't use any like Mellotron. I was a little bit of Mellotron. Is there? I can't remember if there's any Mellotron. But see, I got this really cool program called Mtron that has samples of all these old Mellotrons. And it's just, like, amazing. It sounds just like a Mellotron. And that's what I started realizing, you know, when I first started working with a computer doing music stuff. It's like, well, it's in the computer. It's not going to sound that great. It'll sound digital or whatever. But I realized that, especially with the keyboard and drum sample stuff, you can, I mean, if you don't tell anybody, they're not going to know you don't have a Mellotron. Like, I'm not going to, you know, keep it a secret. But, yeah. If you want it, so if anybody wants to get an amazing Mellotron sound, go to, it's called G4 Software, it's Mtron, and they've got all sorts of Mellotron sounds, and just really cool program. That's all over all my other records. I just didn't really use it much on this one because I was trying to come with a slightly different sort of sound.
Were you trying to go more for a simplistic approach of... What, this year it would be 30 years old now, 31, and next year, the Purple Outside record you did at 90, Mystery Lane. Was it kind of trying to go back to that unconsciously, or was that a conscious choice?
Let's see. Not consciously to that particular record. I mean, I definitely was trying to do something more, a little less, I don't know what you call it. Because I was like getting into, like I said, I was getting into earlier a lot of like garage rock. It was kind of more, so maybe it was sort of, that was the idea, was to go more for the garage rock sound, which I did. Yeah. I did on some stuff, but it ended up kind of mutating into more of a like rock thing, with some of the songs not being quite as psychedelic, maybe lyrically, but still not, you know. Like on Unicorn Curry and on also on the Microdot Gnome record, those are a lot more probably influenced by the English school of psychedelia.
Yeah,
I think that's probably this was less English influence as far as the psychedelic aspect of this new record. Because, Unicorn Curry, I've really been, you can probably hear some of the songs, I've really listened to a lot of Donovan. I think Donovan was probably the biggest influence on Unicorn Curry.
I can hear that actually.
Yeah, there's a couple songs like Calliope, almost like a complete rip off of like Sunshine. That's the thing with rip offs. Yeah. I mean, I got pretty good at it, and the whole band did, like back at, you know, if you can manage to rip off a song but not rip it off, you know, it's like you try to, because Mark Lanegan would always do that. It's like write a song like this song, and sometimes it would work, and sometimes it wouldn't, and sometimes it would work in a way that like it didn't sound anything like the song, but it was a good song. So, you know, like for instance, this wasn't one that Lanegan got me to do, but I wrote Hail of Ashes on Dust. When I first did that, like the end of those lines where it says like glorified in the dying of the sun, I think it went the other, it either goes up or down, and then it went down or up. It was just like the Beatles song that Love to You, the George Harrison song on Revolver. And Dan heard it and he's like, man, just do that the other way and it won't sound like that. And then it's like, okay, now it doesn't sound anything like it, you know. I mean, it's the art of ripping off without people knowing you ripped off stuff.
There's a history of roll. That happens with every band. Paul Stanley.
Yeah, music is a synthesis of what came before, you know, and that's why some bands don't do it so well and get a lot of shit for it, like Led Zeppelin, for instance, when they just completely didn't even bother to fucking say that it was a ripoff, and it was obvious it was, like all those old blues songs. And then there's that. Have you ever heard the original Dazed and Confused by some other guy? There's like some folk guy from the mid-60s, and he's got a song called Dazed and Confused, and it is the song. Except for it's just, you know, like they did it. It's like they did another arrangement of it, but they said they wrote it, you know. They didn't understand crediting songs or something. I mean, nowadays you couldn't get away with that without having to actually, like, there's been a couple of those recently. Those the band The Hives, it wasn't that recently, it was probably 5 or 10 years ago. They had a song that sounded like an old EOL song, like Don't Bring Me Down, like da-da-da-da. It had that riff.
Yeah.
And they actually credited Jeff Lynne for the song along with them. But then there's been some lawsuits, like that one with the Verve, the one with the Rolling Stones symphonic sample back in the 90s, later 90s. Bittersweet Symphony.
I think
they finally settled that one or something. I can't remember how it worked out, but yeah. So you know, ripping off stuff is like what everybody does.
Well,
especially when you're
Paul Stanley.
Out at you.
Paul Stanley is very open that one of the classic Kiss songs they wrote called Firehouse, which there was a band named after it as well.
Yeah.
He heard the song Move on the radio called Fire Brigade, and he liked the idea.
That's one of my favorite songs.
Yeah, so you know what I'm talking about. He liked the idea of what the lyrical theme was. You have to call the fire department because the kick is so fucking hot.
Yeah, right. Because
so that
ladies are hot, right?
Version of that song, if that makes sense. So you know, funny. Yeah, he never has.
Actually, the coolest thing about it. The cool
thing
about it is that Paul Stanley actually was in The Move. The Move is one of my all-time favorite bands. I mean, God, Roy Wood is amazing. He's still kicking around. It's funny because, like, you know, people in the United States really didn't hear The Move.
Still. A lot of people don't know that. You know, it's like people say, oh, well, I kind of ripped this song off. Well, happens. You know?
Well, it's kind of like when you're, you know, you don't have an idea. It's like, what am I going to do? Write a song like this. And it, like I said, it's an art. It's an art, and we always seem to be pretty good at it. I mean, you either have to pick songs that are so obscure that nobody's going to know, or if they're really popular, you got to do it in a way that nobody's going to catch it. Like, there's a newer band I was listening to called Elephant Stone, and it's really good. They're pretty psychedelic, and the singer is they're from Canada, I think, or he's from Canada, at least, and he's of Indian descent, and he plays sitar, and it's really cool sitar stuff. And one of their main songs, like the melody's like right off of, like, is it Remember a Day or some Pink Floyd song? Like, I don't think it was a Barrett Pink Floyd song. I think it was one of the early, like, non-Barrett Pink Floyd songs. But it's a great song, but it's hard to not get that out of your head. If you never heard the Pink Floyd, you wouldn't know, would you? Just like, you know, so I don't know. I said, it's an art.
With
the Screaming Trees. I used to rip off a lot of the, like, Pebbles or Rubble bands, you know, the 60s psychedelic and garage rock bands. Like, the one, finally somebody got this one, In the Forest In the Forest from Even If, and especially when it's, like, the riff, that da 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 da. I got that from a band called the Starfires. And it was the song's like, I Never Loved Her. I posted that song or some version of that song in the forest a while back. Someone was like, "Yeah, Starfires." I was like, "Yes, you got it finally after like 30 years." Someone figured out that that was what I ripped off. Because, and the reason I ripped it off is like, that's the coolest riff ever. But then, like, the rest of the song's kind of lame. It says, "You know, I never loved her," or something like that. And I was like, man, why didn't they use that riff and make it cooler? You know, and that seems like and especially with something like that, that, you know, there's some guy who maybe still alive sitting in somewhere in America who's like 70 or 75 years old, and he, like, maybe hears in the forest and it's like, that's the guitar riff, just like the guitar riff that I did when I was like 16 years old in that band or something like that, you know, so I don't know.
Yeah. That's funny.
So, yeah. So, yeah, ripping off is something that you got to do because that's what all art is. All art is a synthesis of what's gone before. It all builds on, you know, and it's just a question of how new do you make it. I mean, look at Andy Warhol. I mean, he just took what was around and made it into not just art, but art that people pay multi-millions of dollars for now. And, like, you know, he's, like, as yep. famous as, like, Van Gogh or something.
Well, actually, he's probably a little bit more revered because he's more recent than Van Gogh, per se.
Yeah, like, yeah, right. But, I mean, I think, I don't think, as time goes by, you know, you wonder, well, Andy, you know, since Andy Warhol is more of a pop figure and artist, will he fade and become more like, oh, that was just, like, shitty pop stuff? Or it'll be more like he's, like, a classic artist? You know, I think it's gone more, like, in the direction of him being a classic artist than anything else.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, yeah. And you know, it's cool because he, like, involved rock music in his art, too, with the Velvet Underground stuff. So that kind of legitimized, actually, in a lot of ways, that really legitimized rock music a lot more. And it kind of continues to nowadays when, you know.
Rock in the art worlds, I think, for the first time.
Yeah, probably. I can't think of anything else that was like artsy. Like that.
Maybe it's been done somewhat before, but not quite on the scale where you have an artist basically working with a rock and roll band.
No, I'm really not in any kind of music. You know, that was really the first combining art and music.
But most people associate art and rock music together because, like, art is viewed as snobby, kind of, I guess, and rockers are viewed as scrumpy. You know, we're scum.
Well, you know, I think really that's one of the main reasons vinyl is so popular now, is because art and music have always gone together, and the record cover is one of the sort of art outlets that was disappearing because, you know, it's like, well, the little postage stamp on iTunes is really cool. But when it's a 12-inch square thing,
that's tiny. You know, you lost a lot of the detail when it went to CDs and cassettes, though.
Yeah, right. But, yeah, so I know. But, you know, until when it became pretty apparent that records were going to disappear unless somebody did something, people started really doing something and making more of them. But luckily, the means to make them was still around.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I have noticed that the quality of some of the original records, regardless of how worn they are, when I have a record player and convert them straight to a thumb drive, a USB.
Right, yeah, that's cool.
It converts them to MP3, and I can index the tracks, which is great because they're stuffed by the trees that you can't get on CD as we speak.
Yeah, there are things you can.
Or any other format. But I noticed that the original releases sound, I can hear everything in a clear way where it's lost in translation, usually on digital. So, because of that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it depends on what it is, because sometimes they'll take stuff and remaster it again to go on records. But I swear sometimes if they, I don't know about this for sure, because I don't know too much about what SST has done as far as, like, re-release stuff. I've got the idea that they've actually even re-released some of our vinyl, but I think they may just go and record it off the damn CD. I mean, for instance, that re-release of Clairvoyance, on CD, that was recorded off of the vinyl, because I don't know where the hell the master tapes are. And that's the way with, like, all the Screaming Tree stuff. It's like, people, you should put this out, you should put that out. Well, unfortunately, all that stuff, unless maybe the Epic stuff is still together, and Jack and Dino has a line on a few things still, but most of the, like, all those, most of the, like, Velvetone recordings, unless Lanigan has them, they're gone, because he, at one point, he pawned them. I don't know if he got them back. I think somebody got them back. But, like, when he lived in Seattle and was really deep in the dope and stuff, he was pawning anything he could get his hands on for money, including all our old, like, not just the two-track days, but the eight-track, you know, like, stuff. So that's one unfortunate thing about, like, trying to release old stuff. Like, it would be really cool to do a box set. But, you know, maybe SST still has the two-track masters, I hope. Maybe someday we'll be able to get those. But we've been sort of trying to contact Greg again, but it's not easy. And I doesn't really
ask Fisk if he might know the where.
Huh?
Do you talk to Steve Fisk? I could talk to him for you. See if
yeah,
he knows
Fisk,
where they
yeah, I got him on Facebook. Yeah, I don't know if Fisk, he probably doesn't know. Well, see, we had all the tapes. At some point, I guess Mark got the tapes from Velvetone, and there was a box, and they were in our first manager's office for a while in the 90s. And then when we stopped being, that was Susan Silver, when we stopped working with her, Mark got them, and he had them for a while, and then I don't know what happened to them other than they got pawned, and I think he got them back. But then, you know, that was like 20-some years ago. He's been through what I don't, you know. I
yeah,
because he didn't write a book about that part of his life, did he? About the, that's what I thought about his book when it came out, that we hear about what happened to him since he quit the Screaming Trees.
Oh, well, obviously, that he doesn't care about what in the early days, then you realize he probably didn't care where those tapes ended up, which is scary.
Yeah, I know, because, you know, I've got a bunch of the stuff. I've been releasing a few things that I don't really have. I have a few things from Velvetone. But all the stuff I have is, like, digital stuff that people sent me that they got from, like, people taping it off tapes. I've got quite a bit of stuff that two or three different people sent me, you know, from, like, demos, outtakes. The only thing that actually exists in good shape that we're kind of thinking about releasing is we did an Egg Studio, that Conrad Studio. We went in there. And we recorded with Dan Peters, like, a live set. And it was a lot of stuff from Uncle Anesthesia live. And it kind of has a total different vibe than the album, because the album's really compressed and small sounding for some reason. I don't know. That was, like, sort of...
Which is weird, but the EP came out before. It doesn't sound flat to me.
Does it sound different? I wonder if the mixes are different on that EP.
I think I read
somewhere. I don't know. I've never noticed that.
It sounds like Lanigan says "Sweet Ass Summertime" in the title track, "Uncle Anesthesia."
That's what I always thought it was too. He wrote that was one of the songs he wrote most of the lyrics for, because it was like that was a weird song, because it was one of the first times we put several songs together. Like, we had two or three songs, we like threw them together, and then Mark kind of like finished up the lyrics. We did a lot more of that on "Sweet Oblivion," but that was the one song that we did that on "Uncle Anesthesia" like that. Yeah, that's the way. I always, for years, tried to figure out what that Jay Hannon thing, or Gay Hannon. It's like,
yeah, that middle section lyrics for. Even on the part after the chorus.
It's weird. We had two songs. Three, that was a combination of three songs. We had a song called Nightbird. That was like the main part of the song. It was kind of like Nightbird, some song I wrote. You know, it was a little lame, but it was the guitar part was cool. The melody was cool. And then we had another song that we wrote together called Jekyll and Hyde. I don't know if there was ever a tape of it. I always wish there was a tape, because I thought it was kind of cool. And then, so that was the combination of those two. And then the middle part is like a bass part of it's, you can still hear it probably. It's on my
on one of the demo collections called "And I Know Why." The da 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 da. That's from that song. So we threw three different things together and made that song. I don't know why we did that. We had a lot of songs. I mean, that album probably has too many songs. It's got like 13 songs on it. And
yeah.
And plus we had like I don't know why did they. We should have like got rid of two or three of those songs and then put on the one that's on the EP, the Who Lies in Darkness, because that song's better than almost anything else on the album.
Yeah,
I always like that song.
That's why I'm looking
but,
at them.
You know,
see a page. I thought I had read somewhere or something. I don't know that. It was like different takes that was used. I'm not sure where.
Oh, that could be. See, because I didn't really, I never have much to do with it. I didn't even know if I was around for the mixing. Usually mixing, I had enough of mixing with at Velvetone because we always would get in big fights with Steve Fisk and I couldn't hear anything that I thought was helping anyway. So after we stopped recording Ellensburg, I pretty much stayed away for the mixing parts of that stuff.
The only thing I can
there,
miss and the Numb version are basically exclusive to this, except for Who Lies in Darkness was put on the compilation Ocean of Confusion.
Yeah, right. Huh. Yeah, that's interesting. I don't know.
Yeah,
I don't know that much about it than anyone else because, like I said, like the kind of the technical aspect after everything was recorded sort of evaded me and still does.
I'm just unsure if on the record if that part where it sounds like he's saying "sweet ass summertime" is there because I feel like I don't hear it on the record version, but I do.
Yeah, because that's on. Is Uncle Lance Caesar the song? Is that on the EP too? I can't even remember.
Yeah.
Is that what the deal is? I'll have to check those two out sometime. I don't know.
Yeah,
it'd be hard to tell on YouTube too because like you couldn't tell which it's from. But I do have those both on vinyl. I was like, gotta rehook up my turntable. Like
because that makes me wonder because before the record was put out, and it does have two non-album tracks. So
yeah, there was a pretty big period of, let's see, what was it, about 6 or 8 months in between the finishing the record the middle of 1990.
On the B-side of the EP. I think it says August 9th.
Yeah, that makes sense, because right after that we went on the Social Distortion tour. That was a long tour, like about 2 months in the fall. I get the time frames of stuff is confusing sometimes. I remember, I could never figure out, like, especially that year, 1990 was weird because we started off and, what did we do the first, we went to Europe. We recorded that album. Pickerel was quitting the band. We got Sean Hollister was playing with us. Then, because it was weird because Hollister was playing with us, but Pickerel was still recording the album with us. And so then the last, the last show Pickerel played was probably, I think it was in Portland in maybe March of that year or something like that. And that was probably the last show he played.
Nirvana?
Huh?
Would that?
Yeah, I don't know if that was a Nirvana show. It was probably La Luna. We played there 3 or 4 times, so it might have been. If that was in 1990, that might have been the show, yeah.
The
and
one with
Hollister
Batted-
came.
I forget what.
Yeah,
year,
that
right?
might have been. If that was in 1990, that's probably what the one that was. With,
yeah. It was a later ad show, I think, for Nirvana and the Nirvana chronology, as
yeah.
they call it.
But Sean Hollister came with us to watch Pickerel play. And for some reason, I don't know, Pickerel just kind of lost interest. Because, you know, like, and in retrospect, remembering how he played, everyone in the band kind of was like, oh, it wasn't really that good. Because he got, like, the last few months of the band, he just lost interest or something. I don't know. He didn't really play that well. But all the records, you know, Buzz Factory and back, man, he was, like, totally like Keith Moon style stuff. He was really amazing. You know, it really
yeah.
a big difference between Barrett. Barrett's more like John Bonham.
Yeah,
like
and
Keith
that's
Moon,
when you guys
but,
played
yeah,
Friday.
So,
footage, and the drums that he adds to Before We Arise, I thought was very good and tasteful.
Yeah.
He gave the songs energy.
Cool. I don't know why we started playing that one live, because it was like, it was just like, I don't think it ever had drums. It was just like, I played the guitar and Mark sang on it. I don't think it has a bass on the album. That was interesting.
Yeah.
The
one thing I wanted to ask is, do you plan on repressing the Last Words record too?
I don't know. Barrett might. I heard him talking about that. He calls me every once in a while because he still owes me money for it sometimes. Not very much, but we made a little bit of money at first. Still make a few hundred bucks here and there from it. But
you definitely
actually talked to Barrett.
And I, once or twice a year. Even on vinyl, you can't buy a copy of that. It's more expensive to get Last Words than it is Clairvoyance.
Really? Yeah, I'm pretty sure. There may be some vinyl. There may be more vinyl out in stores, but he's all out of it, I'm pretty sure. If he did distribution and stuff, I don't know.
I can honestly
find...
I found Clairvoyance for like $60, but the only copy of Last Words I find that I can afford is like $120.
Phew, that's pretty expensive. I wouldn't say that much for a real India.
Like,
I don't know.
Pressed it once for it to come out.
Yeah.
And I don't even put it on vinyl the first time around, but it was released on Record Store Day in red vinyl.
Yeah.
1 year.
I guess that was that's right. I didn't even know. I never know what anyone's doing. But yeah, I guess it came out in black vinyl first, and then because I know he pressed some more. He used some of the money. And that's always the problem, is like getting the money to press the stuff in the first place. It's like, because we don't have extra money. You know, everyone thinks enough money to live on, and that's about it. So, like $3,000 or $4,000 extra bucks to press records. So lucky to get. Huh?
You've got an audience. There's always the Kickstarter.
Yeah.
If you get it.
I tried something like that right before. I had Van put out the Ether Trippers record on a Strange Earth label. That's kind of like, I don't know, he was kind of hot about the label for a while. Then he hasn't been doing much on it now, but he managed to get that out with he had like a backer, like a guy who has a lot of money, who owns a studio in Seattle. And so he like put the money up to record it, or I mean, not to record it. It doesn't cost much to record it, to press the thing on vinyl. So that was my first, vinyl release. But then, like, when I was putting out Unicorn Curry, what happened is, like, I was like, man, I want to get this out on vinyl. So I was trying, have you ever heard Digger's Factory? It's a place in France. And it works kind of like Kickstarter. Like, you get, like, pre-orders, but you have to get a certain number. And I didn't try to, I had to get, like, 100 pre-orders for the record. But I didn't even get that many. And, I think I got, like, 20 or 30 or whatever. And so I was like kind of disheartened. And right after that, I was like, got a couple people were interested, but Forbidden Place Records, they wanted to put it out on CD, which they did. And then the Vince Bisseruptum, the David Pansel, I'm not sure how you pronounce his last name. He's on Facebook though. The Vince Bisseruptum Records, which I heard of, and they put out a whole lot of like psychedelic things, they put out an album by Twink. Twink was the drummer for the band Tomorrow, and he was in the Pretty Things for a while, and he was in the Pink Fairies. Yeah, he's a kind of legendary psychedelic guy. So, and he still makes records, and he put out something by him. So I was like, wow, that's not really a cool record label. So I was like, kind of wary. Like, I don't know this guy. He's in Italy, and he said he sent me doing like product deal. That's the thing. What nowadays people should be doing is like, they just, the record label, if they do the record, they just give them, instead of like saying we're going to give you royalties, just give them merchandise, the actual record, and you can sell it. And it's worked out really well with him, because he's in Italy, and he if people want to order it from Europe, costs a lot less to get it from Europe, obviously, if you're in Europe, because it's shipped. And he ships me like 50 records or so, and I sell the ones over here.
Yeah.
So, but he's got, I'm going to sell some kind of line on him, the like pressing plants, because he got it done in like, I think from the 2 or 3 months, and he had it pressed and over here. And then like when he did the Micro Dot Gnome repress, you know, that had never been on. It was kind of on CD, some like, what do you call it? Those CD on demand.
Yep.
There's a few of those around. It was actually the first version. It was always confusing because the Micro Dot Gnome was, and I just used it as a band name instead of my name when I first released it. And so there's some CDs that have the Sugar Cube cover with the eye that I did. And
I'll
it's just the Micro Dot Gnome. And the album is called 40 Sugar Cubes.
40.
Huh? Yeah, it's called, the album was called 4D Sugar Cubes. And then in the meantime, I recorded a couple songs, Julian Hades and, oh, that Low Flying Bird, which I was putting out a digital single for Vans record label. But then I put them all together and released it on Bandcamp, just as, you know, under my name. And just called the record the Micro Dot. Kind of confusing, but anyway, so, but he got that out like in a couple months too. I mean, I always hear how hard it is to get vinyl pressed and stuff. I don't know. He does a really good job of it. But he's our, we've got, I got him the files, and we got the record cover together, and it's supposedly going to come out like first part of the year on vinyl. So
nice.
New record, Revelations and Folks.
Yeah. Really. Yeah. And please tell me you're putting it on cassette too.
I don't know yet about cassette or CD. I haven't got anything going on that yet, but, you know, I'll see. Yeah, the guy, the Solid
record.
7 Records guy, I haven't heard from him for a while, so I don't know if he's still doing stuff or not. I might find somebody else to do it if they don't do that.
By the way, have any more tapes of your last album, Unicorn?
Do I have any more? No, let's see. I've got them over here. Oh, yeah, I still do got Unicorn Curry tapes. Yeah. You want one of those things? I got a few.
Oh, I
have
to get that.
How many do you have?
Yeah,
the guy
CD.
Only makes like, he only makes 30 or 50 of them. I got like 1, 2, 3, 4, 6 of them left. He dupes them all by himself and then just, you know, makes enough so he can sell them out.
I've gotten into that's only because they were part of my early childhood.
Right.
So it's a factor. But it's funny because I'm literally waiting, like, you know, the Rolling Stones did the Goat's Head Soup 2020 thing.
What was it? I'm sorry.
The Rolling Stones Goat's Head Soup earlier in September of this
year.
Yeah. Where they did, like, the vinyl edition and everything. Well,
oh, yeah.
I'm waiting another 2 weeks after it's been released in September. I'm literally waiting almost 2 months now late. Because they're having trouble acquiring enough volume of cassettes to send me the cassette pre-order.
Yeah, there's only a few companies that make cassettes. And there was that thing about, I don't know, it was almost a year ago now that some vinyl pressing, no, it was a place that makes the vinyl, like burned down. It was going to be really hard to get vinyl. I haven't heard anything about that.
Ooh,
I've seen a lot of vinyl records coming out. But I don't know if that made a dent in vinyl or not. Because they said that, like, this last year was, like, the biggest selling vinyl year since, you know, the 90s or whatever.
Possibly. And as an unashamed Kiss Army member, I can admit a lot of it's probably Kiss. That pisses me off a little bit because they put up these pre-order release bundles of awesome shit. And by the time I can afford it and I save up, they're fucking sold out. So whatever stock they have... like fucking insanely quick, and that's just one example. So I mean, these bands are losing money on touring and everything else. So what do?
Yeah,
you know?
They gotta make merchandise people will buy.
Like literally, every time you turn around, every other month they're celebrating an anniversary.
Yeah,
and they're releasing something. With these awesome bundles with old shit, like, you know, they redid the Rest Alive on splatter vinyl, so they started to include like old merch you would get, like the fucking viewfinder
You know, you fucking
yeah.
See the pictures of the band that they had back in the day. And people are buying that t-shirt and a poster, not even a record, just the viewfinder, a poster, and a t-shirt for like $80.
God, they must, I mean, on the one hand, a lot of that stuff costs a lot to make, but it probably doesn't cost that much to make, you know? Because I've seen a lot of the bands that make fancy vinyl, like King Gizzard and the Wizard Lizard, they put out this insane, like, splattered, weird vinyls, and they probably make a lot of money on that stuff, I imagine, because people buy it. But on the other hand, it costs a lot to make it too, though. You know,
there's a record in I think Italy as well. I could be wrong. Forgive me if I am. Heavy Psych Sounds.
Yeah, I've heard of that. Yeah,
they do some doom, like the band Geezer, that's from here in Kingston, New York, is actually signed.
Yeah, I've seen them. I've heard of them. I can't remember if I listened to it.
They actually sell like 10 copies worldwide of like test pressing editions.
people are crazy about vinyl now. I think what happened is like the problem is like when vinyl, like the record company stopped making vinyl, it's like, well, they got rid of all the like just regular fans that like just went out and bought the vinyl and listened to it a couple times. And now it's like all the crazy people like want to buy like every single thing by one band, maybe, or maybe a couple bands, and then they'll buy like, you know, like 50 different editions of like 12 different colors or something.
About music, yeah. I've been collecting records and 8-tracks and even laser discs at one point, and I had a player.
Laser disc.
You know.
Yeah, really? A laser disc player? Well, I don't think they ever put music out on laser disc, did they?
Yeah, they did.
Like the big one? Did they? Yeah, I guess they could have.
What did I have on Laserdisc for music titles? I tried to get Nirvana's Live Tonight sold out, but I wasn't paying $100. Mm-hmm. I actually bought a sealed copy of The Beatles' A Hard Day's Night on Laserdisc for like $3 on eBay years ago.
Was it a redone one? Was it like redone, or was it like from when Laserdiscs were actually out, like in the 80s?
It was originally a late 80s, early 90s Laserdisc. It really was. And
oh, really?
Still,
wow.
Like, dollars for it. And
yeah.
I wish to...
Wow, that's weird.
I mean, obviously, I opened it and watched it. And the quality on
was
that...
Was it the kind that was a... Was it the kind that's like a giant CD? Or was it the kind that, like, has a thing inside a box? There's two different kinds, I think. Because I think there's that, like, you kind of insert the box and the CD comes out. So it was like a...
Oh,
it was like
a
that. Silver really record.
It was 12-inch disc, essentially.
12-inch CD, basically, yeah. That's what it looked. That's pretty much what it was. Oh. Different. those things are weird. Yeah, I didn't know they made music on those.
I had GNR Live in Tokyo on that. I had Kiss
Confidential,
which was an early 90s release.
Yeah.
Had a couple of movies too, like Interview with a Vampire.
Wow. Yeah,
or,
I imagine they probably made this in the mid 90s. So.
Came out. I had.
Yeah.
Not that one. Yeah. So like, I had Laserdisc mainly for music, but I had some movies.
That's wild. I didn't even know they made music on Laserdisc. See, that was like, I think when Laserdisc first came out, they were like, "Oh, they'll just take over for records," and it'll be like, which sort of happened. Kind of, but then everything disappeared. Now there's like no format. It's all digital, except for the throwback.
Didn't have anything physical anymore. When it got
I mean, I love vinyl and stuff, but I'm like completely like no format. Like, I stream everything, you know, and I don't buy anything, but I've done it all already. So I guess, you know, I had a huge couple thousand records. That got mostly lost. I still got about maybe 50 or 100 of my records. My wife, on the other hand, has all of her records. We got about half of them out in our living room, although I never listened to them, but we got all sorts of, you know, underground 80s. Her collections, mine was mostly like 60s and some 80s stuff. Hers is like mostly 80s underground and early 90s, like a lot of, you know, the grunge era type stuff that was getting
her. Yeah.
Because she was buying, she lived in New York and she went to Pierre Platters Records. In Hoboken, was
amazing record store. And she go there and she was like, you know, just got a job teaching, like she had a PhD in chemistry and teaching at a college and making money, and all the money she go spend on records and go to shows in New York. So she got to see all the bands, like, you know, in 1988, about 1995, at CBGB's and Maxwell's. And she was like, that's where we met, was at Pyramid Club.
Huh?
You could send your wife my jealousy.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I know. I mean, people find out, like, what she's, the band she's seen. I mean, you name it from that period, she's probably seen it. Like, and a lot of them was, like, at 3 a.m. at CBGB's.
Huh?
Because that's kind of what I do now, but the music isn't as good as it was then.
No, I mean, there was, like, you know, that was, like, yeah, because it was right in the period where, you know, underground music was underground. And like, and then all of a sudden, a couple of years later, when Nirvana hit, all of a sudden it was overground in like a major way.
And
although
you were
a lot of bands are still playing the same venues. Yeah, that was what we.
Can I ask you about the first time you realized that your best friends or your friend's band, because you were friends with Chris more so, and Mark was more friends with Kurt. You explained that. Can you explain?
Yeah.
Oh, I know we've talked about it before, but just so younger people can understand, so anybody who thinks that, oh, they wanted to become famous, can you explain what it
was? Yeah, they didn't want to become famous, as far as I could tell, anybody more than anybody else ever. Everyone's wanted to be in bands and make music. But, yeah, the one time was on the Halloween of 1991 at the show of Paramount. That came out a while back on, like, video and
DVD,
audio. Yeah, and that show was like, it was like a regular Seattle show. So it was at the Paramount. It was like, ooh, the Paramount. And everyone's like, all the bands, you know, Mudhoney, us, and Tad, and probably Bruce and Jonathan were hanging. Everyone's hanging out in the lobby, like it's like at the Crocodile or the wherever, the outside, you know. Well, you couldn't hang out at the Central, but I usually hang out at the sidewalk at the Central. Outside. That's the first time I met Mark Arm, was on the sidewalk outside the Central when he's still in Green River. But yeah, that show was like, you know, everyone's just hanging out, and I don't think there was a bar, so no one was drinking, which was kind of weird because usually people would be drinking beer and so. And then, like, you know, we go in, and Chris was telling us, telling us that they'd sold 300,000 records, and this was like, you know, 2 months after the album came out, and that was like, you know, everyone was floored. 300,000, man, that's like amazing. Like, you guys are like famous or something, you know. And we were kind of like, but after that, all of a sudden, things exploded. You know, that was the last day of the old Seattle scene. Was October 31st, 1991. I can actually place it in time, you know. And then things got fucking crazy and continued to be crazy for another 2, 3, 4 years. So, you know, that was.
And you got plugging away before that, and you were still plugging away at the end.
Nobody, you know, I don't think most people were like too busy getting perused by major labels to think that was the end of it, but it really was in retrospect, because, you know, that was when it switched from being something you did because you liked to something you did because, hey, there's money in it, you know, fame. I don't know. That was never too much of it. I think, you know, I always got the idea that the Pearl Jam side of things, because, you know, there were several different factions of bands. It wasn't like all one big community. There were the bands that were from outside Seattle, like us, Nirvana, who else? I'm sure there's other ones. But a lot of the bands that came from outside of Seattle and ended up living in Seattle later. But, you know, and then there was band within Seattle. You got, like, I don't know too much about that, but, like, Alice in Chains was kind of on one side. They were kind of slightly metal. They, you know, they definitely started out as, like, hair metal band, even though they turned into something else.
They were from
North, yeah, that was like the North Seattle thing, and then it was like people from like Bellevue. I think maybe Jeff and Stone, but although Jeff Ament was from Montana, I guess, but maybe, I don't know.
I just know that for some reason it always seemed like the Mother Love Bone and those guys were like more like wanted to be famous or something. I don't know. Maybe that was an illusion. I just thought, you know, because of maybe the way they dress slightly different. I don't know. They kind of dress up on stage a little more rock.
Say that. And countless.
Yeah, but on the other hand, why did Steve Turner and Mark Arm quit Green River? I don't know. It was because, I mean, because there's nobody less like, you know, like hair metal rock than Mudhoney, obviously, you know. So, oh, the Melvins, they would have been another band from the outside of.
Yeah, well, the thing is that from what you said, it's not an illusion. That's been documented and said.
Has actually, it? Okay. See, I don't know because I only know about it from my own personal perspective of what I saw. You know,
that is exactly what happened because even in the Mudhoney documentary I'm now, Jeff Ament and Gossard were talking that the Green River was opening for Jane's Addiction, and Jeff and Stone actually.
Yeah,
really,
there you go. Yeah.
Wow, this is how far we could go with this. And
yeah,
Mark
I saw that show when they opened Jane's Addiction.
Stock, and they were just like, whoa. That was the first time they realized they had two totally different directions and just kind of went off in their own.
Yeah, because, I mean, Steve Turner and Mark Arm are not.
I think even Silverman.
Like, metalish at all.
Stone came from more pop metal territory.
Right. So I guess it wasn't an illusion. Because I didn't, for some reason, I just did not like. I never really listened to Mother Love Bone. I saw them live once. I thought they were pretty good. But you know, the thing is with Andy Wood's thing, he was basically parodying the hair metal big rock arena thing. And unfortunately, I imagine if you saw them at the Central, it would have been pretty cool. But in the Paramount where I saw them, and I think this was when they opened for Jane's Addiction, if I'm not, it seemed like he was just like, pretending he was David Lee Roth. That was the, you know, I only met him once and I just like, hey, how you doing? Like, he came down to the Reciprocal studio one day and recorded in Buzz Factory. But, you know, that's what it seemed like to me. It's just trying to be, you know, it seemed to me like they would have been the kind of band that would have moved to LA to get famous, you know?
Yeah.
Because that's. And then I remember when the Hunger Strike, the Temple of Dog thing came out. I had it on cassette, and we were on tour. And I didn't really listen to it much. I just didn't like the whole vibe of it. And I remember reading the kind of there's something on that cassette was like we're all together and something like, you know, sort of a artsy sort of liner notes. And I was just, it infuriated me. I smashed the cassette. I don't know why. Man, remember that. I was talking to him a while back about that. And I was like, years later, I kind of regret it. Because, like, well, you know, I mean, I like Pearl Jam stuff. And I like, definitely like Soundgarden, you know. I mean, we played with them a lot. And I really think,
that
you know,
record is too mopey to me, personally, to celebrate someone from that scene. It just seemed. There's some beautiful songs on it, but I don't regularly pull it out to listen to, and that's not a slight against the band. It's just, I don't know.
Yeah.
Maybe it's subject matter, but, I mean, there's no variation of songs. They're all slow-paced ballads.
Yeah, well, that's like I was saying, though, the kind of dichotomy in the music scene that people don't think about now is where you had bands that were just like, more like punk rock, and then bands that were more like rock, R-A-W-K. I don't know. You know, just
it's like taking
like guys that might dress up with something, but guys that wouldn't.
There's almost three sides because you guys, along with Love Battery, and a couple, if I am correct, had more of a psychedelic tinge, and Mudhoney could fall into that too. But
I would say Mudhoney is closer to that.
Then you had the punkier side, which you could have Nirvana, you know, Tad, Fluid, more punk inspired, punk oriented. Because in the metal, you had like the Alice in Chains, and I guess the Melvins, Kurt once wrote that he liked the Melvins before they came Black Sabbath.
Yeah, right, right, exactly.
Well, it had more of a metal-oriented sound. I think Grunt Truck could be that as well. More
yeah,
metal.
Definitely, yeah.
I liked the
yeah.
punkier side and the psychedelic-y side more so than I do the metal side of the grunge genre. Because
yeah, me too.
Side was the only one that seemed very restrictive in any way, shape, or form. And Alice in Chains
yeah.
is amazing. Did really heavy stuff and really light stuff, but I'm talking, they didn't have the same experimentation that you guys had, that Nirvana had. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. Although Alice in Chains really, I mean, I always liked them back then. And I always, like I said, since they kind of came from the hair metal thing, I sort of dismissed them, but then when we started playing live with them, it was obviously they were really good. But after years and years, I really, you know, I really think that their stuff is like weathered time more than anything, probably more than just about anything really, especially Dirt. That's one of the most best records from the time period. Probably all time.
And like talking it, but it didn't have the same musical dexterity that your records have, that Nirvana's had, and that might sound crazy to some people.
Yeah,
Nirvana.
All the well, see, there's a certain type of guitar playing that turns me off. Like Jerry is a great guitar player, but he definitely is influenced by some of the. Is it what do you call that? Like you know, like a really good guitar player, like Yngwie Malmsteen, Eddie Van Halen, for instance. Like Eddie Van Halen, he's an amazing guitar player, and had a whole style that he invented. But on the other hand, I just never really liked that, you know, the with the weird overtones and really fast thing. I don't know, anything that sounds kind of like that. That was one of the reasons I could actually stand Guns N' Roses sort of, because like Slash doesn't play like that really. He's like more of an old school, like Joe Perry type of guitar player.
You're more like
that.
Well, wait a second. How did you like my guitar stylings? I have a lot of shred in my style.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, it's you know, it has a lot to do with the. I guess it's technical is the thing. I just look at, you know, it's like somebody's like more into like technical side as opposed to just like playing.
Just doing what raw, your SD.
Yeah, because all my influences are guys like, you know, Ron Ashton or Greg Ginn or you know, people who just sort of aren't very technical.
I get what
yeah.
you're saying, same way. People always say about how great, I mean, I think Randy Rhoads was better than Eddie Van Halen, and I'm not trying to knock any Eddie Van
yeah.
Halen. But I'm just saying, I always felt like, even though they're both the similar, very similar type of classically trained guitarists, I feel like Randy had a better feel of where to put things, where sometimes Eddie just kind of
yeah,
wanked
right.
off.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know for sure that Eddie Van Halen invented that whole. Were there other guitar players probably that were playing the same type of thing at the same time? That might, maybe there were. Cause like,
well,
never
Randy
really
Rhoads
explored that too much.
That piece on the strip too, so they both were on the same
yeah.
turf.
So they were. Yeah, he was probably the same age as Eddie Van Halen, huh? And started
yeah.
about the same time. So. Yeah, I imagine if something had started in L.A.
Yeah. Kiss struggled in the 80s to find a guitar player because everybody wanted to play like Eddie Van Halen. They went through two
yeah, I know. And definitely, first. Yeah. And Ace Frehley was definitely old school style, you know.
The guy ended up settling on after they went through a guy named Vinnie Vincent and a guy named
yeah.
Mark Saint-John. They settled on Bruce Kulick, who could shred when
right.
they needed him, but had more of the same influence as Ace had. And Ace
right.
recently prayed. So, I mean, you know, I get it. I get where you're coming from, and I understand.
Yeah.
I don't like thrash metal, and I don't like Metallica. So anything that's like...
Yeah. I know. Like, what do they call it? Math rock. They have, it's sort of like that. It's sometimes not as heavy, but that's like a whole genre called math rock. And they're real, like, intricate. Fast riffs and stuff like that. Yeah, I don't know, man. Although I was really into King Crimson, like way back, like when you know, like his whole reformation in the early '80s. He was really like into it. These little fast riffs and stuff that were crazy. But
Iron did that later.
Yeah. So I don't know. Yeah. So in the context of Seattle scene, though, really that not too many people played that way. Like, you know, McCready, he was definitely old school style.
Yeah.
I mean, I never listened to him too. I remember for instance, the solo on, what is it, Alive, you know, that's totally like Hendrix-ish sort of, old school guitar playing, which he did on that, on Dying Days. Okay. Yeah, solo on Dying Days was really awesome that he did.
That was a really good
I got to check it out. Somebody on the Scrimmage website, somebody had a tape, I haven't listened to it yet, of the show we did in 97 at the Showbox where he played with us and he played the solo on it. I got to listen to that because it's like on the fan club thing. Like some guy was putting a bunch of download things. I thought I had most of them, but I don't think I have that one.
Oh, wow.
You can like get them off of Dropbox. Yeah, check it out. It was like a week or two ago. Maybe.
On iPhone, I can't do that directly to my iPhone. So.
Yeah, I'm going to probably download it and maybe put it up there eventually. I just didn't want to do it right away because it was like, oh, you just ripped my thing off. I feel bad about like somebody sends me stuff or like I just like take it off. And because like, you know, especially when I post like the Unheard Scream and Tree stuff, it's like I said, it's all this, I don't have tapes of it. I lost all my tapes years ago. I mean, I have all my own stuff. I have all my four tracks and all that stuff. But I don't have a tape deck. Well, I sort of have a tape deck. I have a four track still, but it's so old, man. This thing, when those four tracks get old, the rubber in them starts disintegrating and stuff.
Yeah.
They're kind of, and it's hard to find new parts. Easier is to get a whole new deck. But I had one that had like the two speeds and Dolby and like trying to find another one, like it's too expensive. Like they're not cheap now. So now, years ago, I got a bunch of stuff that I ended up putting on those demo albums.
Yeah.
And remixed it and stuff. So I tried putting it on digital, like the four tracks. That's why I got a four channel like interface and just downloaded it straight to four tracks and then tried mixing it on Cakewalk, but it just sounded harsh. It didn't sound the same. I don't know. I never could get a good mix. So.
Yeah.
Because there are a couple things that I like. The Scrimmage's Beat Happening album. That's like we recorded that on my four track.
Oh, wow.
And then we had Steve Mick. We took it into the studio in Ellensburg and had Steve Fix mix it on the board there. So we put a few stuff, like effects in it and stuff, but it was all just done like on the four track.
He's a good guy. I asked him if he'd sign my Other World CD case.
Yeah, he's really cool.
He signed the case.
Yeah, he's right. Yeah, I was wondering if he still smokes pot. He was like one of those like producer guys that smokes so much pot, it's insane. Now it's legal in Washington. I wonder if he still smokes pot. I don't know.
I signed my Screaming Trees Beat Happening EP since he produced it, and I don't feel comfortable doing that because all I did was record. They really did it themselves. So fair enough. You know, I only asked him to sign Worlds because he did play on it too. You know, he played organ.
Yeah, he did. So I gotta go. I got a couple calls. I gotta get here. So
you're perfectly fine, man. Real quick, just in case, you know, I have to go through the stuff. So like, as far as we're sitting here, you're trying, but you're having trouble. Or you want to release Screaming Trees stuff, like past stuff?
Yeah. Yeah, there's one, like I said, there's one thing that we may release that's like a live version of a bunch of stuff with Dan Peters on drums that Jack and Dino has in his mix. And there's one original song on there also called All Is Heaven that was originally done for the Changes Come EP that didn't end up on it. So if I can get bands, been kind of on and off, not with it lately. I mean, I talk to him every two or three weeks, but he's still trying to get his shit together. So and he's like our main, huh?
I've tried to talk to him a few times.
Nope.
I know. Well, he's just got a lot. He's really struggling with, like, alcohol problems.
Gotcha.
And family problems. I mean, he got divorced about 5 years ago. He's got three kids. They're all, like, growing up now. But, you know, he's still dealing with that. And on the other hand, he had a good job. He just quit. He works for, like, the power utilities districts. Makes, like, $100,000 a year. But, and, like, the only reason he has a job is because, like, they like the screaming trees. And he keeps, like, fucking up and, like, leaving the job world. But he keeps coming back. You know, so he's like a government job and he's got really good health care and retirement. But apparently, a couple of weeks ago, he said he quit the job and was trying to get some other job. So I don't know. That's sort of been his only stability in the last few years is that job. So I don't know what's going on with him now. But he's my only contact, really, with the old. Well, I talk to Barrett occasionally, but Van's not around. Although I a little contact with Jack and Dino. So I was trying to get, I got a couple songs that I want to put out as a single, but Van's being lame. I was going to have Van play bass on him. Yeah, because Jack and Dino actually played drums on him, and he was going to mix it. I don't know if I'll put it out if Van doesn't play bass, because the idea was there were two songs that were written, like, way back, like in the middle of Screaming Trees that I redid. I was going to do them for the album, but then I wrote some other songs. So that may come out eventually as a single. It'll be interesting. If I can get Van to do the play bass. So.
any contact or have you and Mark really?
Oh, Lanigan. I've had a couple of messages from him. He seems sort of regretful of, pretty regretful of all the stuff he wrote about me in the book. So I don't know. You know, I mean, and the thing is like, it's not all not true. It's true that I was acting full of bizarre a lot of times, and it's true. But, you know, just to, after 30 years, to bring it all up and act like I was some kind of monster or something was just sort of like, okay, that's nice. Thank you. But,
yeah.
And I'm pretty much over it. And he's,
I've read a book and come to you a few times about shit like, did this happen this way? And you're like, no.
Yeah. I mean, the last time I heard from him a couple months ago, he was like, kind of interested in like me playing on some stuff that he was working on. I don't know. I don't really know if I want to or if I will do it or if he will get back to me, but we'll see. I don't know.
Hey, could be a Hal Branches, I mean, Screaming Trees reunion.
Yeah, you never know. I mean, you could do it. That's the, if it ever happened, that's the only way I think it could ever happen is if it all was like everyone recorded their part and it was all just a, you know, an album. Or maybe more like a song. I don't think there's just no way. You know, I don't think I could. And the other day, I made that video the other day, and like trying to, you know, pretend. One of the hardest things is pretend like you're playing. You know, did you see that video I did for I did those heavy freaks? It's on. You want to see it? It's on YouTube. But you know, I was trying. I hadn't like stood up and played for so long. I was kind of like, and I have like bad tinnitus. And vertigo, and so I don't think, you know, I would like fall flat in my face the first song if I tried to get up there and play. So I don't know. And probably everyone else is like that too, I imagine, although Lanigan does manage to play live, at least until the pandemic, so.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I would hope that it would happen and that I would get to see you guys, but if it does happen, I would only hope that it would happen in the way that I think would be respectful to all of you. You know,
yeah.
It's
just, you know, if we all live in the same town, maybe someday, but it's just like, you know, I'm all the way in Texas and I'm not sure about this, but the last time I heard from Lanigan 2 months ago, he claimed that he moved to Ireland. Now, I don't know how he moved to Ireland in the middle of a pandemic, and I wouldn't really question if he did or not, but as far as I can tell, Lanigan is now living in Europe. So that's pretty much, but I don't know how he fucking got over there in the middle of the whole pandemic thing. And then Van is Seattle and Barrett, but in Pickerel.
Yeah. Oh, man.
So I don't know.
Anything else?
It's not just as easy as going down and playing with each other. Anyway, yeah, that's probably my thing now. Touch base on the records. Just go out and buy some form of Revelations and Bows. or just listen to it. That's what I realized, like, you know, when I put out Unicorn Courier, it's like, I think it's better just to be able to have people listen to it. Then they'll buy the vinyl maybe, or, you know, maybe eventually they'll buy the... So I just made all the on Bandcamp, but you can stream it as much as you want. And then you just have to, if you want to download it, you have to pay for it. But then, and I put the album up on YouTube too, so you can just listen to it as much as you want. Actually, you could just use one of those YouTube downloaders and download it if you wanted to. But like I said, the main thing I'm worried, you know, I'm not trying to make money off of music or anything anymore. I make a little bit off the Screaming Trees, but I'm just doing it because I want, you know, it's nice to have people hear it. And the main reason I do it is because I like it. You know, like that's with this record and with the Screaming Trees too. I'm writing something and recording something that I would go out and say, man, I really like this. I'm going to listen to it a lot. You know, if I don't do that, then I'll know I'm doing something wrong, you know, and just about everything I've ever done and released is like that, you know, so.
Well, it's a great album, and the fuzz at times sounds like a goddamn air raid siren. So if you're into fuzz, that's really up there out.
I have such trouble with guitar sounds. I don't know. I use a lot of the digital, like, amplitude for the guitars. I've done that for a long time, but this time I wanted to use more amps. I got a Vox modeling amp that also has a tube in it, and then I also got an old, like, really old Supro amp that I've had for ages that I got working all right. But all my sounds, they always sound muffled, so there are some live amps on some of the rhythm stuff, but most of the solo stuff, I just put I got a new fuzz box that's got germanium transistors called a fuzz factory, made by a company called Zvex, and it sounds a lot like the old Univox ones and stuff. But I put that straight in with the wah pedal straight into my computer interface and got some really interesting sounds. So it's a little different guitar sound than some of the other albums I've done.
It's not a bad though. It's so, like you said, it's less of the Mellotron and less English and more American garage.
It's more in the it's more pebbles as opposed to, although it's weird because, like, I always try to, like, write. Like, the only time I wrote stuff that I thought would sound like it would maybe be on Pebbles is, like, Other Worlds. Everything else always ends up having this, like, other feel that's, like, something like early Screaming Trees was. And obviously a lot of my stuff sounds like that because I wrote, you know, majority of the songs, especially in the early days. So.
Oh, yeah, without a doubt. Even the Purple record, which is on Bandcamp as well, you posted it up there. That reminds me of a lot of the earlier albums too.
Yeah, well, there's, like, I've got a bunch of those songs by the Screaming Trees. I released one of When I'm Gone, the first song that's on YouTube, on my thing from several weeks ago. Almost all of the songs, not all of them, but seven or eight of them, were recorded by the Screaming Trees first, and I've got them, not very good sounding, but they're, you know, they're like files that I've got, digital files I've got that were probably recorded a couple times, different tape, cassette tape.
Yeah.
But you can hear what they kind of were like, though. So I'll probably release a few more of those, too, because, I don't know, I thought about doing a record of it, but I don't really got any connections to do it, except for Van. It's sort of lame. Like, you know, maybe a CD of the stuff would be cool. But then you got to, like, talk to Mark, and you got to, like, ask everyone if it's okay, blah, blah, blah. So I figured I'd just release some of mine on YouTube. Because, like I said, I'm not trying to make any money, really. I just want to have people hear stuff, including the old Screaming Tree stuff, which, you know, which I've been doing some on the, I don't know. I was always scared that Lanigan would get pissed, but after the book, I was kind of like, I don't care. Because now that I fucking release stuff, he can just, you know, I'm not like I'm making money off it, so he's not like, you're not paying me for that stuff. And it's all stuff that I got from other people anyway.
From what I understand, your brother wants to kill him.
Yeah, I never wanted to kill Mark. I just don't understand, you know, because I just don't want, you know, it makes me feel bad to think that I made someone's life hell like that for so long. But, you know, it was reciprocated on away, pretty much, you know. I mean, the first couple of years we were in the band, we were kind of, you know, everyone was sort of friends, and then it became like, well, we're working together, and we really want to do this because we like putting out music, and we like writing songs, and we like, you know, didn't really like playing live that much, at least he didn't, and, you know, but we got to somehow get along while we're doing this because, you know, we all had our own personality problems and getting along with, because like I was such a fucking hermit, you know, and probably autistic. I never probably will know for sure, but I still am like that, you know. I mean,
it's no secret.
Martin said something about when I last note, he sent me something about that we're probably autistic or something, you know. I don't know. Yeah, it's weird because, like, I mean, especially from my daughter having the autism, I really learned a lot about, you know, because when I was in high school, there was a guy who was autistic, and he was, like, never talked at all. He was in, like, our gym class and stuff, and I didn't, you know, really know, because, you know, there's a whole, like, it's the spectrum thing. Some people are so bad off they can't even communicate, or they can't even, like, get along at all with people. And some people are just, like, you know, pretty much the smartest, coolest people you ever met in your life, and it's just like with anybody, it's like there's a whole spectrum of different people, you know. It's like, so it's kind of too bad that the autism word sort of gets in the way of people's lives. I think it does hurt with my daughter, because, you know, it's like, well, I don't think anyone would guess that she had autism if they, you know, said it to you too, and like, you know,
for
she's
me,
really smart and
out at a young age, and I was diagnosed as a teenager, and
See, she wasn't diagnosed till she was a teenager either, so it's kind
of
like, what is wrong with her?
Some of my past relationships, they've said it's probably because your Asperger that we didn't work.
Oh, speaking of, she's calling me right now, so I gotta go and talk to her, so, but just message me to get the thing together, and I'll talk to you later, okay?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You have a good day, and take care, man. And
okay, you too. Thanks a lot. Have a good one. Bye.
Bye.